So we come to the end of a two-month-long series. It's actually sort of 3 months, if you think about it. We spent the month of May talking about our new mission statement, Love, Serve, Follow, and preached about that and taught about that. And then over the last 2 months, we have gone down this long list of these core values that we claim as a congregation, not just for ourselves collectively, but the kind of ways we want to live in the world as individuals. And so there, last week, Reverend Chris preached about how hard it is to forgive completely. We talked about how important it is that we teach our children creatively and our youth and raise them and form them in faith. And Byron talked about welcoming openly and also encouraging each other warmly. And so we've been on a long journey together. I hope that you've enjoyed this time. One of the questions you're being asked in the survey today is actually, which of these core values do you most connect with? Which is most important to you, or which of, maybe more than one, are most important to you in your own spiritual life? There are some other fun questions on here as well, with some serious questions. I hope that you'll take a moment to fill that out. And just so that you'll remember the journey we've been on, you've got a fan. Now, you would have really appreciated this fan about a week ago, when it was about 102 degrees. But hopefully this will be just a fun reminder of some of the things we say we are about as a congregation. All of these important words, encouraging and listening. And today we move to this phrase, walk humbly. And it's a great way to wrap up our series. It's a great way to sort of put a big umbrella around all of these things that we say. All of these are ways of walking humbly with God together. So if you can go to the next, thank you. You can even go to the next slide for me. Thank you. So I want to talk a minute about Micah. We don't know a whole lot about Micah. Micah was an 8th century BC prophet. He's one of the minor prophets. You know, who are the major prophets? It's a little quiz for you. The biggies. Who are the biggies in our faith tradition? Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, the big guys. And then we go to these 12 minor prophets, of which Micah is one of them, like Habakkuk and Obadiah and Jonah and Micah, all those prophets. So we don't know a whole lot about it. It's only 7 chapters long. But in the tradition of all the good Hebrew prophets, he does what a good Hebrew prophet's supposed to do. He speaks truth to power. He talks about the ways in which a lot of his words are directed to the ruling elite, both the religious authorities as well as the political authorities. And the way that if you're only making sure that you're taking care of the people at the top, you're missing God's call to care for all of God's children. And so there's some very memorable passages in this very short book, but probably none as memorable as what we find in the 6th chapter. There are only 7 chapters, so it's almost the climax of the book, but I think it's probably what most of us can recall. I have this text over my desk. It's just right behind me every day. So I see Micah 6:8, this culmination of this text, every day to remind me of its significance. It starts out as sort of a courtroom scene, if you will. Only the courtroom is all of creation. God says, I have a controversy with my people. I've got a bone to pick with you, Israel. And he calls on the mountains, and he calls on the very ground of the earth. He says, to be my witnesses. What is it you have against me? Why have you forgotten me? I have never, ever, ever forgotten you. I am the God who has saved you through the wilderness. I am the God who has saved you through the waters. I am the God who has never been anything but faithful to you. And then the question becomes, well, what do we do in return? And that question about, well, how shall we worship our God? How shall we respond to this God? Does God want of us empty ritual? And does God want more burnt offering? Does God want rivers and rivers of oil or thousands of rams? No. No. God has shown you what is good. You know what is good. It's not about putting on a religious show for God that's ever going to earn God's favor. But here's what it is, Israel. What does the Lord require of you? You know this. Do justice. Love kindness or mercy, and walk humbly with your God. We would do well to put that in our wallet or our purse or put it up on the wall like I have on mine. This is one of those core foundational texts that it's undergirded Christians and Jews alike for centuries upon centuries. This is who we are. This is our response to God. Now, I want to talk about each of those pieces of that, if you will. To do justice. What does it look like and what does it feel like to do justice? Can you go to that next slide for me? Thank you. There are 9 words. This is one of those things that I sort of knew. I observed myself, but I'd never seen it put together like this. One of the biblical scholars I was reading this week said that when you see the word justice in the Bible, here are the most common words, the 9 words that you're almost always going to see one of these other words. When you're talking about God's justice, you're always going to see also the word widow, fatherless, orphans, poor, hungry, stranger, needy, weak, and oppressed. Which is to say that to participate in God's justice in the world is to care for the people who are most on the edges of society. Is to give these people, because one of the common threads in all of these different groupings, all these different descriptions, is that these tend to be people who don't have social standing and don't have voice in the process. And so to advocate on their behalf and to make sure that structures and systems are fair so that we do not forget the most vulnerable in our society. That was a very, confirming and also convicting thing for me to read this week. That when we talk about God's justice, our accountability is, how well are we doing to care for all of these people? God's justice is not just feeling sorry for someone. God's justice is making sure that everyone has a fair shot. It's not just going to visit the prisoner in prison, which is God's compassion and God's kindness, and we ought to do that. But it is looking at our whole system that imprisons disproportionately certain groups, and it's looking at what happens on the other side. How do you help somebody make a new life on the other side and get a fresh start? God's justice demands that we not just care for those who are hungry, right, and make sure that we feed. That is God's compassion and God's mercy. We ought to do that. But we ought to ask the harder questions about why are there some people who have a lot and some people who struggle to get by and have so little? What can we do to make it possible for all to have enough to eat? Those kinds of systemic questions. God's justice is about this. Now, I went to an antique store this week, and I stumbled on something that was sort of a wonderful surprise. It's the life edition of the inaugural spectacle from 1961, when JFK was inaugurated as president. And I love old Life magazines. Being a photographer, Life sort of is a chronicle of 20th century American iconic photography. So I'm always looking at old Life magazines. And there's some wonderful images in here of the women in their gowns and Washington, D.C., which was blanketed with a surprise snowstorm, 8 inches of snow that sort of shut everything down and threatened to cancel the gala the night before. And so they were getting people there in milk trucks and people in their galoshes and long gowns. And the amazing show that they had lined up for the gala, there was you might remember the summit, Nat King Cole and Harry Belafonte and Ella Fitzgerald and Gene Kelly and Janet Leigh and Tony Curtis and Milton Berle and Frank Sinatra, all singing and dancing and performing in this gala. Pretty amazing. And then pictures from the day itself as the transition of power is taking place. You've got Eisenhower and Kennedy and you've got Nixon and Johnson, and so all of these amazing scenes. And right in the middle of this is the text to the inaugural address that Kennedy gave. And I reread that this week. It's something we've probably heard about and we read about in history class along the way. And we know some of those more famous lines like, ask, and so my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. So you remember those words. But earlier in the speech, Kennedy, now this is against the backdrop of the Cold War and the realities that are there in 1961, is talking about first, what are our responsibilities to each other as a nation? And he talks a lot about justice and rights and making sure everyone has a chance. And I could not help but hear the words of Micah echoing in my ears, doing justice and loving kindness and walking humbly with God, doing justice. There's a lot of language in here about justice and caring against systems of poverty. And at the end of his speech, he ends like this, with a good conscience. He says, how are we going to be judged in the end? The final judge of our deeds is going to be history. You're going to look back and see what we did. Let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own. And what is God's work? What is good? To do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly. It's kind of fun to revisit that speech and to remember that. I want to move ahead to this next phrase, to love kindness. What's it mean to love kindness? If you remember from our Psalm series, we talked about that word chesed. Anyone remember that? Sound familiar? Chesed, loving kindness, God's loving kindness. We looked at all the different kinds of psalms, the fist-waving psalms, the prayers of lament, the prayers of thanksgiving. But there is this phrase that appears over and over and over again in the psalms, and it's about God's steadfast love, God's covenant loyalty, God's deep mercy towards us, and how we are called to live into that love and embody that kind of love for the world, that kind of, that chesed, that loyalty, that steadfast love, that compassion. All those words sort of go together in a cluster. I heard a story this week that reminded me of that, that embodied that kind of love. I keep forgetting the guy's name, so I have to look for it. Samuel James. Samuel James is a musician, and he's fairly successful now. He's got a stable life, but it wasn't always that way for him. When he was a young man, he was moved around between 8 different foster homes. He had a very unstable childhood. Almost every year, moved from school to school, home to home, didn't have a lot of friends. So by the time he was a senior in high school, he just was so close. And he managed somehow to be a pretty good student in that, good enough student at least, that he was hoping and dreaming of going to college until he got kicked out of that last foster home and sent to a shelter. And so he'd sort of given up. Now, along the way, he was sort of a loner. He didn't have a lot of friends because he kept changing schools, and he was very no self-esteem and no confidence in his life. And he was a bit of a loner, but he had become friends with this young woman that he would see on the bus. Her name was Jenny. And she was a loner too. She kind of kept to herself. And he said, "Can we be loners together?" And so they struck up this friendship that mostly just existed conversations on the bus, and they would have conversations by phone. And that friendship was a lifeline to him because he didn't have any other friends. So when he went to the shelter, he tried to maintain that friendship. She was the one person that he continued to call, and he didn't tell her he was in a shelter because he was afraid that she would write him out of her life too. And one day he let it slip, and the conversation got a little weird. He called her back the next week from the payphone at the shelter, and she got on the phone. She said, "I want you to talk to my dad." So he's picturing, okay, I'm going to talk to the dad. The dad's going to say, "Leave my daughter alone. I don't want my daughter hanging around with people like you." And the dad said something totally unexpected and totally remarkable and totally kind. He said, "Samuel, would you like to come to live with us?" He said he was blown away by that offer. He had never met this man. He barely knew his daughter. And here he was opening up his home and offering him a place to live so he could continue to go to school and maybe have his chance in college. He said he was scared. One of his impulses was to run away, but he took the offer. He came to the house. He said they were as gracious and welcoming as you could ever imagine. He said, "I was not very good to them. I was an angry young man at that time in my life. And looking back, I was pretty mean. I didn't open up. They poured out love and care on me, eventually reunited him with his own father. And helped reestablish that relationship, supported that, advocated for him in the system. He went on to college. But he never forgot that radical act of kindness. I think when Micah is talking about God's loving kindness, about us, our call to love kindness, it looks something like that. It means opening up our hearts to people and giving them a chance. It means taking a risk on each other. It means loving mercy. It means some people are going to mess up and we give them a chance anyway. Again and again and again. Loving mercy, loving kindness. And then the final part of Micah's call is to walk humbly with our God, which is not so easy. I was talking to Ron Shippey on the way in. He was telling me about the great round of golf he was having this week over in Queenstown. And he said that four of the first 5 holes, he had parred, he had 1 bogey. He said, "On the 6th hole, I got a 9. And I said, "Yes, golf is a humbling game, isn't it?" Life has its way of humbling us at times. Circumstance will humble us. But Micah's call is that we humble ourselves before God. That we don't just wait for circumstance to do that to us, that we choose that posture, that we take on a way of being that allows space for other people, that doesn't, we don't have to be the most important person in the room, that we invite somebody else's significance by our tone, by our the way that we interact with people, that there's the humbleness of heart that we bring. Now, I'm going to give you a caveat as Lee puts this next slide up. Don't throw anything at me. Because this is either your hero or your goat, depending on where you sit politically this week. But I want you to tell you, I picked this quote and this slide earlier in the week, on Wednesday. This is when John McCain had come back to the Senate in a very powerful and moving scene. Some of you saw this. He was welcomed back in, not as a Republican, not as a Democrat, just as a colleague. Everyone was happy to see him across the aisle. And he gave a heartfelt speech to his colleagues and his friends. And what he basically said to them is, all of them, Democrats and Republicans alike, everyone included in the room, he says, we've been playing this game too long of making ourselves too important and forgetting about all these people that we're supposed to serve and care for. And this was the line that really grabbed me. This is why I wanted to quote him this week. I hope we can again rely on what? Humility. Humility. And what does humility look like? It's our need to cooperate, our dependence on each other, to learn how to trust each other again. And by so doing, better serve the people who elected us. Now, if you want a closer to home example of what humility looks like, there's George Sims that we said goodbye to this week in a memorial service on Thursday. George was a humble man. He was one of our own who came with Charlene at the 8 o'clock service, kind of a quiet guy. And I learned a lot of things talking to his family this week. I learned about his career, and I learned about the fact that he loved chocolate meringue pie, and that for his birthday, he would get a chocolate meringue pie, and everyone else would get one to share. And I learned great stories about them going hunting and camping out in West Virginia, where he was from and had grown up. But his daughter, Kathy, sent me back an email after we had met together and wanted to make sure I included this in the service about him. And this is what she wrote. She said, Daddy was a humble man, not showy or ever wanted to draw attention to himself. He never asked nor expected anyone to do anything that he would not do himself. He never felt he was any better or above the next person. Never felt he was any better or above the next person. That's what it looks like to walk humbly with God. To walk with an estimation of ourselves as beloved children of God, as gifted children of God, but to not be feel like we're better than anybody else, no matter what our economic standing, no matter what our educational level is, no matter where we've lived, all of those things don't matter. We are all children of God together. No better, no worse. We don't look down on anyone. And I want us to live as a church, to live that humility. I want us, when we are in mission in the world, to live not in a sense of paternalism, that we look at us, we're pretty cool, and we've got something, we're really fortunate, and you're not. And so we're going to do this for you. I want us to always, whenever we partner with anybody, want it to be a partnership, a relationship. I wonder we were serving at Heaven's Kitchen. I see Chip nodding his head because he knows that it's the attitude that we bring to those relationships that matters. Whether it's our kids out on ASP, or whether it's our adults going away on VIM trips, or whether it's somebody who walks into our church, which happens every week here, and they need help with their rent, or they need help with their electric bill, or they need help with the gas bill. And you would be so proud of the way that Beth in our office handles every single person and treats them with dignity. We never, ever want to look down or make someone feel like they're looking up at us and begging. In humility, we've been called to serve and love each other. C.S. Lewis said, true humility is not thinking less of yourself. It is thinking of yourself less. That's what it means to walk humbly with God. Not that we deny the giftedness in us that comes from God. Not that we act modest, you know, falsely modest and say, we're not really that much. We are. God has created us to be wonderful, complex, amazing people, but we're never to wear that with pride, always with gratitude. And out of that, offer blessing to someone else along the way in a spirit of humility. Don't ever think of less of yourself, but think of yourself less. Wouldn't that be a good way to live? Then we'd all be walking humbly with God. What does the Lord require of you? What has God shown you? It is good, the good life, the full life, the meaningful life. It is to do justice. It is what? To love, kindness, and it is to walk humbly with our God. Thanks be to God, and thanks for walking with me. Amen.